Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence. I'm thrilled to feature award-winning filmmaker Chloe Zhao on the show today. Chloe's the director and writer of the feature film Songs My Brothers Taught Me. The film is Chloe's directorial debut and was produced by Forrest Whitaker. Songs My Brothers Taught Me premiered at Sundance Film Festival and Director's Fortnight at Cannes Film Festival. Chloe was named one of the 25 new faces of independent film by Filmmaker magazine, and her film was nominated for Best First Film, Best Cinematography, and Someone to Watch Award at the 2016 Independent Spirit Awards. Songs My Brothers Taught Me is set on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and the film explores a bond between a brother and his younger sister, who find themselves on separate paths to rediscovering the meaning of home. In Chloe's episode today, we discuss options for financing of films, her background and how it shapes a beautiful work she creates today, ideas and inspiration, the importance of letting go, advice for filmmakers, and Chloe breaks down exactly what film labs are and how they are a tremendous resource for filmmakers. For you listeners who are working on a script or if you're planning to direct your own project, you definitely want to pay special attention to Chloe's interview. Now let's jump right in. Hey, storytellers! We have Chloe Zhao here with us today. I'm really, really excited to get chatting. How did you first fall in love with storytelling?
I grew up in Beijing. I was born in 82. So I grew up at that time period, we didn't really have a lot of TV shows or movies, but I did have a lot of Japanese comic books. And I kind of just devoured that as much as possible. And in a way, comics are like storyboards. So I think at a young age, I was really obsessed with telling stories one frame at a time. So even though I didn't study film or wasn't thinking of making films until I went to NYU graduate film program, I think that love, that passion is always part of me.
Did you first move to New York?
No, I left when I was 14. I went to England first. My family stayed behind in China, and I left. I went to a boarding school. I was just excited to not have my parents around.
I know, right?
They're like an ocean or whatever.
Did you know that you already wanted to go to NYU?
No, because NYU is MFA, so that's grad school. So I went to LA, finished last year of high school, and then I went to Mount Holyoke, which is a women's college in Massachusetts. And I studied political science over there. And then I moved to New York. And like everybody else with a liberal arts degree, I become a bartender. And it was fun for a little bit. And the 3 years was pretty long. I did odd jobs, you know. And because liberal arts degree is a little bit like, you know, a lot of my friends go into investment banking or they go to law school, they go to grad school for journalism. And I thought, okay, maybe I should go to grad school too. And then I went to film school.
What got you interested in political science first?
I was pretty sheltered when I was in England. I mainly studied studio art because in England, you could be quite elective when you're in GCSE. I was at A-levels as well. You know, by the 11th and 12th grade, they already only picking three subjects. So, you know, I wasn't studying anything but art. And I went to LA High, which is in the pretty, I'd say, relatively rougher part of the town. And I think I had a really, and that was the year I really felt like I grew up because I really had a sort of realization of every, you know, how little I know about how the world works, especially coming from China and the education I had growing up. So, you know, I had an amazing government teacher, Mr. Feinstein, who sat me down after class every day to try to get me to understand, you know, and LA was very racially segregated, and this is 1999, you know, and I was just, this is not the America that I saw in movies. So I was like, where's the white people? I just didn't really understand. I was so ignorant. And I think you know, that's probably why I ended up focusing on racial relations, because I was trying to understand, which is a very specific issue that belongs to America, the way how race affects the politics and society. That's very different than China. So I became very interested in that, and I studied extra hours with Mr. Feinstein. And 3 days after I started college, 9/11 happened. And I remember everybody switched to international politics. And I was just curious, you know, what is this country that I've been fantasized about back in China growing up, and what is it make attracted to that three, you know, that two planes into the towers? You know, what is it, you know, everything I've seen in the past year in LA, that I just wanted to understand the United States, you know, even though I think a lot of people went to study international politics. So our American politics department was actually quite small. And I wanted to work for the government. Maybe I didn't know exactly what, but I knew I wanted to be in politics. And it takes studying politics for 4 years to not want to have anything to do with it. It's like, no way am I being part of that. But then, you know, I also had an opportunity to get to know, and I also, you know, sort of took enough classes to be able to have a studio art minor as well. You know, I wasn't just doing politics, but then I got really interested in a lot of more community-based grassroots organizations that are, I find, to be more effective than being part of the bigger machines. You know, and a lot of times, you know, art education is a very interesting thing for me, especially for communities that doesn't have a lot of access, because I didn't have a lot of art education growing up in China back in the 90s. So all that kind of started making sense, you know, all blending together. And film, you know, as a medium is something that I felt like, you know, I'm not a master of anything. You know, I'm not a great, I couldn't draw the comics. I wanted to be a manga, you know, artist before. But
oh,
I couldn't
that's
draw.
Awesome.
I couldn't draw very well like everybody else. I went to conference, you know, like a Comic Con kind of thing with my portfolio. I'm like, oh God, no, I'm never going to be as good.
Oh, no.
And film, in a way, is kind of like the way technology kind of levels out things a little bit in film, where you could have a lot of support around you. That people that are really masters at what they do, and all you need to do as a director and writer is to come up with a world, and you know, to bring these people to help you realize that. So I think it naturally becomes my choice of expressing myself.
Ooh, I love what you just said. I think that's brilliant. So now that we know that you transitioned from political science and why you don't want to be involved with political science.
I mean, do you blame me? Look at what's going on.
I mean, I don't blame you at all. I'm glad you got out now. You know what I'm saying? So good on you. But I'm so glad you're directing, because you're putting out amazing films like Songs My Brothers Taught Me. How did you get from that moment that you realized, okay, I want to do an MFA in directing and filmmaking?
The Pine Ridge film is actually my third year. That's when I decided to do, which is, I can answer that as well. But the how do I went to film school? By the way, I never stopped reading comics.
Oh, I love that. Even better.
Something I don't talk with my independent film friends is that I'm actually still a huge nerd, and I read all the comics, and I watch all the movies that are a TV show that come from comics.
I love it. Even more authentic.
My
That's
filmmaking
so cool.
is very far from that world, but I'm very, you know, very knowledgeable of that stuff.
That's so awesome.
So, and I think even when I, you know, at a very young age, you know, going back to my roots, you know, back to China, I was writing a lot of fiction online. There's always online communities that you can write fiction, and I never stopped that either, to write and read. And they're definitely not, you know, literature worthy fiction. They're just fiction for fun, you know, and sometimes they're as simple as scripts. They're not very descriptive. It's just a way of getting stories out, you know. And so I don't think going to film school it's not like I never thought about filmmaking. It's, you know, it's always, it's in my mind. And when I was in college, I took a class as well, like an introduction to production. I mean, we don't really have a proper film department at the time. And then just, I had a little flip cam and, you know, go around and, you know, with wanting to write and then wanting to tell these written stories in images and interested in people's lives. Just all these things are just come together really perfectly. And it was at a time, I remember I was 27, 26, I forgot. I was thinking, okay, I have to go to grad school. I have to do something with my life instead of bartending. And I looked up NYU deadline, which is a month from the day I looked it up. And I quit my job. I was like, because they require a lot of creative material. And I don't have any of these things. So I spent that month getting all that together. And once I got in, even with Pine Ridge, you know, I wish I have a really spiritual, cool story to tell you how I got there. But I'm pretty impulsive, and my decisions in life are, since I don't have my parents telling me what to do, are usually led by impulses. And with Pine Ridge, you know, I felt a little bit lost being in New York after living here for almost eight, nine years at the time. I was looking for answers that I don't think I will ever find in the place I'm at. And I think it's human nature to want to go west when they're seeking for answers. And I think historically that's that's kind of a pattern. And I was looking west. I had a lot of interest in the Great Plains because I was interested in places that where nature is now completely harnessed by men. And, you know, I've lived in Beijing and LA, New York, and China is a big agriculture country where you really dig up the land and you develop, you know, but the Great Plains is not really exactly a place you want to plant things. So the way the nature of the land is still wild and it carries a sense of history at the risk of sounding a little. You do feel something when you're there. That's something wild that you as a human being can control, whether it's how extreme the weather is and the way people live so far away from each other. So, you know, I feel like we put a lot of pressure on ourselves as artists, as human beings. You know, every decision we make, we're completely responsible for that. Like, we control our destiny. We have a vision that we create, and then we're going to do whatever we can to make it into a reality. That's a lot of pressure to play God. So being out there on the reservation and being in that land, it was an amazing experience because both as a human being, as an artist, I started to kind of see there's a bigger force out there that you cannot control. And that's a very freeing experience for me, both spiritually and artistically.
I agree with you. It's very primitive. Completely get that. Because for me, I love connecting with nature. And it's very humbling, too. It's just to get out of the city and go camping and realize there's a bigger picture. I'm just a little part of this big world. And to let everything go, let all those little things I'm trying to control, it's out of my control. Like you were mentioning, stop trying to play God. So I love how you said that. Thank you for that. That was beautiful. Very poetic too. So that's awesome. Now, Chloe, I just wanted to also ask you, going out there and seeing all this, how did you come up with the main character, the high school senior Johnny, and his little sister, 13-year-old sister actually, and their beautiful relationship with each other, two strong siblings? Where did that come from?
I didn't overnight let go of playing God. So I was writing a script for 30 drafts. I wrote for 3 years. I went through the Sundance Labs and Film Independent Labs. I've done, you know, workshops and grants. I did a lot of writing, and I had a specific plot and story that required a certain budget. I was very ambitious, you know, especially after I got into the Sundance Labs. You know, I felt like I could really do something with this project. It would launch my career. And the reality is I couldn't get any funding for the movie. By the third year, Johnny, you know, at the time, the film has always been about whether a boy is going to leave or stay home, because I wanted to explore the very complex relationship people have with their home, the idea of being trapped in this border that you call a reservation, you know, the sovereign nation, at the same time being very free as well, this very complex relationship they have with their community. And so it's always about exploring that. But we couldn't get money for the film. I had to let go of this script that I've been playing God as an artist, as a writer for. I had to let it go. And I only had some grants money, and a little bit of equity money, and it's about a tenth of the budget of what I needed to make that script. So I think being out there for 3 years, by then I was slowly kind of able to let go of that control. So I shot the film without a script. Wow. I shot the film with a 5-page treatment and kept the main story. Jay Sean wasn't even a character at the time, and like she wasn't in the movie. So I kept, you know, the main storyline: is this boy gonna leave or stay at the only place he's ever known? And by then, I already met all these interesting people, like the Indian cowboys, like Travis, the tattoo artist, like Jay Sean. You know, I met these people. I didn't have any roles for them. So in a way, by freeing myself from that version of the script I had, I was able to include these people. So I shot without a script. It wasn't, you know, and if you know, to focus in, and in the end, to decide Johnny and Jay Sean, and then also in the editing room when we had a lot of material, to still focusing on the two of them, it's because a lot of the young people on the reservation, over 50% of the population, are teenagers because of the low life expectancy rate and because of, they have a lot of kids. So we see a lot of young people taking care of each other when their parents are not around, and for folks that are not theirs, you know, they also struggle with, they deal with a lot of trauma that, you know, that we don't address. And that kind of brother and sisterhood is so strong. And that's something I, as an only child from a generation of only childs from China, mm-hmm. is a relationship I never had as well. So I was curious about that, and I knew that was one of the core relationships people have on the reservation. And then I met Jay Sean, so it just makes perfect sense to make it about the two of them.
That's so interesting, because it reminded me of you, your personal story, where you were also, you grew up really quickly. As I have two younger sisters, I'm like their mom, so I have that mom-daughter relationship. And I guess it's because you're an only child, you have that genuine curiosity, because maybe you've been missing that a little bit in your life, you know, just wondering yourself what it would be like with siblings. And Chloe, I'd also love to know, was Johnny, he's an actor?
None of them are actors except the mother, the girlfriend, and the white woman with the camera. So everyone else is born, raised, and still live on Pine Ridge.
Wait.
And by the way, like, you know, Johnny and Jay Sean, they both have, John has 25 brothers and sisters.
Oh wow!
So it's real, based
it's
on his
a real.
Life. Yeah, the cowboy that was giving the eulogy.
Yeah.
He's his father in real life, who has 25 kids. So in a way, he gave himself a eulogy. You know, that was improvised, because I said, okay, give a eulogy if you were giving it to yourself, basically. Because that's him. You know, he is Johnny's father. And Jay Sean is one of is the oldest, like you. And she really, like, raised her little sisters, who are a lot younger than her, very similar to your experience. And she always told me that she wanted an older brother. The two of them, you know, clicked right away. I didn't really have to do much acting work with them for the relationship to be established.
How on earth did you direct that? Like, my little sisters were doing some acting, and I was helping coach them for their auditions. It was difficult in some ways, but also a really beautiful experience. But then I'm trying to imagine, for, like, let's say, if I were in your shoes for a film, to mm-hmm. capture that. And then it wasn't just like coaching on the side. It's, you're capturing this on film. And I was like thinking, wow, these kids have really good training. How are you able to communicate with them to receive the performance that you needed? But I know that you're saying you kind of scrapped the script and you're going by a treatment, right? So, and I think that's a beautiful thing about it. A lot of it came off like an improvisation, almost a documentary-like film. With the treatment, you still have an outline. So how were you able to communicate with these actors and receive that performance to go along with your outline?
When I wrote the outline based on who I met, the people that I could put in the movie, I was 80% sure that they could play this role that I wrote for them. Even Victor, who is like the guy, the gangster, the bad dude, he, you know, in real life is the nicest guy ever. But I, you know, but even that, when he was younger, he understood what it was like to sort of be in the gang with his boys, you know, because a lot of the young people sort of had that. The gangs that doesn't really, it's not scary at all. It's just sort of a form of brotherhood. So he understand what it's like that, at least trying to play tough. So I knew he could do it. Jay Sean was the only, I mean, I was wondering, because I didn't know Jay Sean very well when we started shooting. I only met her once before we started shooting, but I knew she was very sensitive and she's gone through a lot in her life for such a young girl. She was only 11. So I knew I could make her cry. I think this sounds terrible, but
no, you gotta do what you gotta do.
I knew, yeah, so I knew, you know, and I knew that she kind of liked it. She liked that she was able to access to some the emotions. You know, she was a very expressive and creative child. So I knew she could do it, but I wasn't. She was the only one I was a bit unsure. She turned out to be wonderful, but everyone else, I wrote the role based on who they are, and if. Let's say I don't usually rehearse. I mean, I rarely do. But if after two takes, they're just not giving me what I need, I'm not going to go up there and try to push it. I try to rewrite on the spot because there's different ways to get to where you need to be within the scene. And if you have not like rehearsed a million times on your script and if you one of your scenes needs to be exactly the way it is for the next one to make sense, let's say if you have a script, you know, it's a little hard. But even when you have a script, you still could kind of, if you take some time, if it's not working the scene, you know, you could still step back and think about how can you get to where you need to be for that scene to get to the next scene, but use different ways so your actors can have another shot, you know. So I don't force the kids to try to remember their dead puppy as much I do sometimes, but I'm not pushing that method acting on them because they weren't trained.
I'm gonna go back and watch it again because now it's like a whole new way of watching it, you know, and I think that's fascinating. I love knowing the behind the scenes and the story behind how the cast came to be, and they're real people. I think that's phenomenal. What's your take on education when it comes to filmmaking?
I don't think you need to go to school for it. I mean, I've obviously, you know, gained a lot. I met some great mentors. I made some friends. And I was able to, you know, have the NYU name, you know, when I try to apply for grants and stuff.
Yeah.
But for me, I didn't come from a film background. I don't have anybody that I could make films with. And I needed a break in the industry. And I also I'm not disciplined to do it on my own. And I think a lot of people could probably relate. It's like arts is like, because filmmaking isn't like music or something that you, I feel like there's like someone who has something in them that makes them a genius, or they, I don't know, like they just go do it. Filmmaking is a little bit more vague, I think. So it's very hard. It's not like if I just practice drawing every day, I'll be able to do it, or if I just practice the violin every day. So filmmaking is harder, and it takes a village. So you do need to have financial support, you need to have people. I'm sure if I were a different person or I had more discipline growing up, I probably could bring some people together in New York, which is filled with people you could collaborate with. I probably could have made short films myself with the money I pay for tuition, you know, and did it a different way. And, you know, if I have kids, I would encourage them to do it that way. I don't think people should go into debt to study film.
If you feel comfortable, could we walk through the steps of your filmmaking process, like actually bringing it to life?
Sure.
For example, Sundance Labs, that's for the screenwriting, correct?
Yes, I did screenwriting and I did directing and I did music. And then after I wrapped the film, after I finished shooting, I did the sound lab as well. So I did a bunch of Sundance Labs. So the first 3 years was developing the film.
That's in the Sundance Labs?
The Sundance Labs is like the writer's lab is usually a week long and the director's lab is 5 weeks long. So I've done the labs within those 3 years of developing. And I also did the Film Independence Screenwriters Lab before the Sundance Labs. I won a grant. It's the Chris Columbus, who is the director in Hollywood. And he and Richard Vague has a grant that they used to give NYU students who are making a feature. And so I pitched it to them and I won that grant. And that grant turned out to be the reason why we couldn't make the film, because we couldn't really get that money anywhere else. After 3 years, we couldn't get the money. We had part of that grant left, and then we got a little bit more money from a private investor. But altogether, a little bit over 100 grand. It was very little.
Oh, wow. That's really impressive.
It's very low. And then we made the movie. After we made the movie, I cut together, you know, it was depressing times. You know, I was sitting in my room with this hard drive thinking like, no one's ever going to see this. We have no money to even pay rent right now. And so I edited together a couple of scenes and I showed it to Forrest Whitaker's production company, Significant. And they came on board to finance our post-production, which cost almost twice as much as production. Because the way we shot the film, I edited the movie for a whole year. We had, you know, Skywalker sound. You know, we had some of the best people to compose music. And so the film really was polished in post. And then we raised a little bit more money for our distribution, or, you know, going to festivals and going to the world.
Okay, so now for those very beginner storytellers, the very beginner filmmakers, a really great option is grants. Is that what you're encouraging for grants and to try for these?
Film independent. And also there is, and it's because after we wrapped, we also did the IFP, which is based in New York, IFP lab that does, they do all kinds of labs, you know, financing labs. They also do post-production lab, which is what we did. So Film Independent is based in LA. They produce the Spirit Awards, LA Film Festival. And IFP is based in New York. They produce the Gotham Awards, and they're just a big organization.
Could you go a little bit into what labs are and how they help you as a filmmaker?
For anybody who doesn't go to film school, you can just Google, you know, independent film labs or like writing labs. There's plenty. And it's not just those three. You know, there's a lot out there. And so you go there. They're actually, all of them probably nonprofit organizations. And you go there, they find mentors that match with your project. Like, for example, Sundance Screenwriters Lab, I go there with my script, and then they bring in mentors, writers, directors from all over the place, and then they read the script and critique and get, you know, and then you go back and you work on it. And then you do the director's lab, which Film Independent has and Sundance has it too. That's pretty more extensive commitment. You go there. I did the Sundance one. I go there with my newly written script, and I pick five scenes. They bring, you know, four film crews onto Robert Redford's resort, Sundance Resort in Utah. And they bring trailers for editors to be in. So they, you know, you spend a day rehearsing and you spend a day shooting, you spend a day editing. And then at the end of the third day, you have people like really, really amazing directors like Jeff Nichols, you know, actors like Ed Harris. You have all these amazing mentors in every department, from cinematography to editing to writing. Like 10 advisors sitting there, directors, to critique your scenes. Wow. And they have read your script by then. And then you do that over and over for like 4 or 5 times with different group of advisors. It's a big investment that Sundance put in on the people they mentor. It's an amazing, amazing privilege to do that.
To get there, it's a competitive process, right? It's not like anyone can get selected. It's a competition, basically, right?
It is. And I think, you know, even if you can't get into the Sundance labs, which is, it's just a matter of like what kind of project they're looking for. It's not necessarily who's better. But there's many other labs. The Film Independent has same kind of writer and then director's lab as well. It's equally good. And, you know, now this time around when I'm writing, I just do these little workshops myself with my friends, and then I send it to my mentors. I just spoke to a young filmmaker earlier on and I said, even if you don't get in while you're writing, you know, if you're writing a film set on a ranch, you know, get a couple of ranchers together, buy them a meal, read the scenes and act it out and learn from that and go back, rewrite your dialogue. Don't just completely get stuck in your room and write. So there's many ways to do it. Like I said, you know, I was very lucky to go through these things. You know, it's not the only way. And go back to the the financing thing, the grants is not what I would recommend. That's for people who have no other choice. And again, if you look at the boxes to check for like risks for investment, I'm a female Chinese young filmmaker, first time making a film on a reservation in South Dakota, which is not a place you make films, with a cast of non-actor. This is everything that people don't put money in.
Oh my gosh.
But when it comes to nonprofit organizations, they love to support that. So there's a big disconnect going from these amazing institutions who I feel like on the top of the world, then going into people whose money needs to be paid back. I'm not saying those people are wrong. Our country, our government don't put enough protection and help, support to our arts. That's it. You know, you go to France, they protect that. It isn't just about making money. So for independent filmmakers, it's been really difficult for the producers and for the investors because they don't get their money back these days. And we're still trying to figure out how to change that. So I'm not blaming anybody for us not having got some financing, but I understand why everybody is so scared to take risks.
Right. Now, and I know you mentioned that you went to Forrest Whitaker's company. Did that happen while you were in your lab's process and they introduced you to his company? Or did you reach out, just you did your research on Google and you're like, you know what? His studio seems to fit my vision and I'm going to just pitch at him cold and just see what happens.
I didn't do that. I went to the Sundance Labs with Ryan Coogler, who directed Fruitvale Station and Creed. So he, you know, put a really good word in for me because he also worked with Forrest on Fruitvale Station. And then the Sundance mentors also made introduction, put a good word for me. So I got a meeting with Forrest. But when we just opened a film forum in New York, the film, and Forrest was doing a Broadway play. So I said, can you do an introduction for the film? You know, so he came to film forum and and I've seen plenty of people, including my friends, people I know from school, just went up to him, introduced himself, and got his number from his assistant so they could send him their scripts.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, do that as well. You know, don't, I'm a little more shy. I probably would do that more to an actor. Like if I'll go up to an actor, I'll be like, please be in my next movie.
Yeah, like I really love your work. I've seen it before.
Yeah,
so
I'm not shy when it comes to that. Yeah. But when I go up to someone and say, can you give me money to make my film?
Right, like, I would be the same. I wonder if it's our Asian culture. It's like more like...
It's totally the Asian thing.
It is. It's...
One of my producers is an Asian American. You know, I'm Asian, not really Asian American. We always say that. We're like, oh my God, Jesus. You know, it's just like... Why can't we just, we have the
just
same
ask,
issues.
You know what I'm saying? My dad's very much the person that's ingrained that into us. You can't say that. You can't ask that. That's very embarrassing. There's no face.
Totally. It's about the face.
Oh
it's like,
gosh.
Give me a couple of shots of tequila, maybe.
I know,
you know?
Right?
But I don't. Oh and God. I'm looking at people, wow, they're really, I really admire that, but I don't have that in me, which is great. There's many different ways to get to... So me, instead of doing that, I'm just like, I'm going to apply to every lab there is, every grant.
How long did it take since the first conception of your project? Was this like a year and a half? Like this was, oh, no, you said 3 years, right? It was like 3 years in the making?
Well, right now, it's been 6 years since I started working on this.
If you can meet yourself 6 years ago, what would you tell yourself specifically when it comes to like funding and getting the film made?
I would tell myself to put my ego in check. I let that ego of mine to kind of lead what I think that I should be as a filmmaker, what my career should be. And it's very difficult to be in the film industry and not let those noises affect you because, you know, you see like people getting ahead, going to the festivals or they're getting what deals. And you get really anxious about it. And then when you're anxious, you're not centered and your ego takes over. And when you do succeed in something like get into the Sundance Labs or things like that, you really get a big head. You know, I was reaching out to like Naomi Watts to be in my movie to play the white lady in the film. I was like, what was I thinking? You know, it's I don't even know how to get her out there in South Dakota. So it's you know, I try to make things so big, but forgetting where I was, you know, and then realizing that this project was always supposed to be what it is today, which is this small film. And because it's just not possible, that film that I was writing. And so I would have probably got to where I needed to be a lot faster with a lot of painful mistakes. So yeah, I definitely take blames for all those detours we took.
Now that you've learned all that and know what you would and wouldn't do if you had the chance again, are there any projects in the work right now for you that it's a new project, or are you continuing with pushing Songs My Brothers Taught Me?
Oh, I'm not pushing that film anymore. I'm so dumb.
You're like, I'm exhausted.
It's like being in labor for 6 years. And like, no, there you go. Done. Go to college. I'm not even raising you. No, the film is dumb. You know, it traveled for a year at festivals, and now is in distribution, and then it's just going to go online. That's it.
I resonate very much with those films that independent organizations create. And I think it's phenomenal. It's more stories like that need to be told. So I tip my hat to you for, no, seriously, I congratulate you.
What you're saying, you know, is like, if there's another thing I could tell myself back then, is like exactly what you said. I wish I'd enjoyed those little miracles.
Yeah,
along
the little triumphs, huh? Right?
Yeah, totally. Right? You know, I look back, even thinking myself, I wasn't even that. I was happy when we got into Cannes, but did I actually enjoy the festival?
No, because you're so stressed out. This ties back again when you are out there on the reservation and you're seeing the bigger picture and you realize things are out of your control. You're like, okay, I'm doing my best, but sometimes you know when to step back and to just go through the process and enjoy it, right?
Yeah.
You shouldn't always be focusing on the next thing. I'm curious too, because you said that you moved out at a really early age. You studied by yourself. You grew up really quick. Now that you're a filmmaker, are your parents proud?
They are now. I got into Cannes. I think that was definitely, to be fair to my parents, they are Chinese. They live in Beijing. And, you know, Chinese people have different Twitter and Facebook than us, you know.
Yeah.
So they really are not connected to America in any way. Right. So they don't know what I'm doing here with Sundance. They never heard of Sundance. My dad was like, Park City, is that the ski resort? I'm like, yes, you can ski.
No.
So they don't really know what's going on. But when I called him and say, guess what? I got into Cannes. And that is a huge thing. And then my dad, you know, they came to Cannes and we had a standing ovation at the premiere. And so for him to see, you know, for a Chinese filmmaker to go to Cannes, usually they're quite established in China, whether the government likes them or not.
Oh, awesome. Okay, so your dad knew Cannes.
Oh, they all of them do.
Okay, amazing. Perfect.
Yes,
perfect.
They all do. And to go back to that, you know, we make jokes about the Asian, or the, you know, the East Asian culture a little bit. But, you know, this is probably why I think I'm attracted to making films, you know, telling stories of a culture of the one that I'm not from. Because in that way, I got an opportunity to learn from them of what I lack, but at the same time appreciate what I have that they don't. And it's just a great process of, you know, also developing as a human being for me to be able to do. And to go back to, you know, this whole thing of just to have some time off, like offline, having some time away, like you said, in nature or whatever that get you centered is so important for a young artist, especially because our mind is easily influenced at this stage, and to figure out like who we are and what kind of film stories we want to tell. And that even in when you're writing about other cultures and when you're telling stories about other cultures, there's something about you that's in that story always. And if you be quiet about it and then, you know, acquire your mind, and you'll hear that, you'll find that. And that's what's going to end up in your editing process or in your writing process, guiding you of what kind of story you want to tell.
That is so true. You always find those connective pieces. Mm-hmm. My girlfriend actually does this thing called Heart of Dinner, and she brings all these people together from all different walks of life. I'm talking about, like, we have straight couples, gay couples, Pakistanis, whites, Asian, any race you can think of, any background, any work, from nonprofit organization people who are trying to stop nuclear weapons to people who love singing as a living. Like,
these people, it doesn't matter what background, like you're saying, doesn't matter the cultural background or anything, there's always that common thread that ties us all together, and we can always resonate because the stories are so much deeper than like different cultures. You know what I'm saying? And I know you said you don't want to touch songs my brothers taught me. You're like, no more. These kids can graduate and don't come home for a while until they get a full-time job. What are you working on right now? Is there anything that you're excited about right now that you can share with us?
Yeah, I'm actually, I've learned from songs a lot, and I enjoy working with non-actors, but at the same time, I also like to work with professional actors. That's why I'm writing two scripts. Just because I'm one of the producers of the film, so I kind of, it's very difficult to try to accomplish if you want to bring a very well-known actor in, but also have a bunch of non-actors, because sometimes you can't really control the lives of the non-actors. The kid, you know, some of the young people, for example, you don't know where they're going to be. So in the producing aspect, it could be a nightmare, especially if you want to make a film in the heartland, which is, you know, on the Great Plains, which is what I will continue doing. So it doesn't really have an infrastructure for film out here. So it's even harder. So I'm writing two scripts, both set on the Great Plains. And one is set in the sand hills of Nebraska. It's about a small town that's struggling to survive, and how the Keystone Pipeline XL had really sort of brought the town, like sort of tear people apart and eventually brought them together in sort of a little bit of last picture show kind of way. And I'm writing that for professional actors. I mean, I will have some non-actors supports, but, you know, it is written for actors. And I think, you know, and I think there's a lot of great American, you know, legendary actors, you know, could really portray that era, especially some of these older ranchers and you know, people in those small towns that are trying to hold on to something that's disappearing. So, and then I'm also working on a road movie about homeless kids that live on the road on the Great Plains. And, you know, it's very different to live on the road, to be homeless in Montana than in New York City. So it's actually quite a problem for kids that run away. You just never find them. And then they really form. And it's something that's very American. You don't see kids in China busy running away from home to live on the road. It's because America is really built on the road. It's a road culture. And it's the idea of if you stop, you will die. This type of seeking for freedom and what freedom means for everybody. And that's all. That's going to be with non-actors.
That second script, like, how did you come across that idea, that summary, the synopsis? Like, that's really fascinating.
Well, because I've been kind of homeless my whole life. I'm only recently sort of find a home in Denver where I feel like, okay, I'm actually going to settle down here. So I kind of been drifting my whole life. And especially in the past 5 years, I basically live out of my car. I'm always on the road in the middle of the country, and I've seen I've met so many interesting people, seen so many interesting places, and I want to show the Great Plains, which is, you know, some of the biggest states. You know, it's Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota. These states, I wanted to show. It's going to be pretty epic, you know, because I want to show it in different seasons, and I wanted to show all these people and places that how people live in a way that people haven't seen before. And it's obvious, you know, it's a story about a girl as well. It's not just a study of a place. It's a story about, it's a love story, and it's a story about this girl who really just, you know, she really embodies that need, that useful need, that American need to be free, and what are the consequences she has to pay for that. So, you know, and I felt like that's what I had to struggle with in my life, to be free and to be able to be, you know, spontaneous and just adventurous. But then I paid a lot of price for that.
Man, Chloe, I am so excited for you. And
thank you.
Really, like, I would love to have you back on the show once those scripts are gone through and talk about your processes again. And I'm so excited to see what happens to those ideas and to see it come to life, because just seeing what you've done with your first debut film, it's fantastic. So I'm very excited for you, truly, Chloe, and I wish you all the best. I really, really do.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been so much fun.
Hey, storytellers, that wraps up our interview with the ever so awesome Chloe Zhao. Thank you so much, Chloe, for joining us on the show, for sharing your personal stories, and for passing on all the tips and advice from your experiences as a kick-ass filmmaker. And as always, a big thank you to the Storyteller Tribe for listening in. To find out when and where you can watch Songs My Brothers Taught Me, go to songsthemovie.com. For a list of Chloe's recommended books to read and films to watch, be sure to head over to her show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Chloe Zhao. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!